pleased indeed to welcome the now distinguished professor of South Asian history at the University of Virginia, UVA in Charlottesville. Before that, she was a professor of history at the University of Texas in Austin. And Indrani has developed new areas of research in South Asian history, including institutions of monasticism, slavery, and the household, and has used the lenses of gender and sexuality through which to examine South Asian history. So among her publications are Gender, Slavery, and the Law in Colonial India, which is quite a long time ago now, that publication. Unfamiliar Relations, Family and History in South Asia, and Forgotten Friends, Monks, Marriages, Memoirs of Northeast India. And today she's going to speak to us, she's going to present a lecture entitled Gendering Yajwani, Recasting Governmentality and Capital. I'd like to extend a very warm welcome to Indrani on behalf of OCHS. So we're very much looking forward to your lecture.
Thank you very much, Gavin. But I want to begin, of course, by thanking all of you for being here, but mostly by thanking Lucien, who encouraged me to apply for an OCHS fellowship first. And I'm, of course, very humbled and gratified that Gavin and Shaunaka Rishi Das accepted my application, despite the fact that I was not a religious studies scholar. So I want to begin by saying that I did learn, and I continue to learn from all of you, and I hope some of that will be clear in what I'm going to say today. So let me begin by identifying the stakes of why this should matter, or why this matters to me as somebody who is adjacent to your specialty area of Hinduism studies. I'm going to begin with Gavin's quote, in fact, from his defense of the phenomenology of religion from 2021, where he, in fact, defended phenomenology against the deconstructionists by, you know, getting it quite right. He says that they accuse the scholars of religion of ignoring the structures of power and oppression, particularly of women and the colonized other. But Gavin's response is that this critique itself is reductionist, I agree, in that it does not seriously take emic claims into account. And what I found especially resonant with my work is that this critique does not regard human aspiration to verticality as having any kind of explanatory force. Now, you will understand why I'm drawn to that phrase, because I have worked on a whole historiography of slavery and Atlantic historiography mainly, whereas the South Asian pre-colonial contexts are very different. And that's why Gavin's work or phrasing resonates with me, because there is so much in the Shaiva as well as the other later traditions, including in the Sufi formulations of Bandai Darga and, you know, Dasatva and so on, that the devotee addresses the deity and so on. So that attraction of verticality as central to humans speaks to some of my concerns. And I want to push Gavin's work a little further by saying that the Marxist, I'm agreeing with him, but I want to, in fact, take the critique that Gavin's offering further by saying that the Marxist historical sociology is itself ignorant of its own historical roots. And that self-constitution is explained much better if we look at the Iberian, that's the Portuguese and Spanish, Catholic, and especially after the 15th century, anti-Islamic, anti-Semitic, and colonial categorization schemes, that is devised by peninsula-born Iberian men. So this is what that project identifies as casta, And it's spread by Dutch and English and French ideologies and mainframe as consonant with class. I think this is easiest represented visually in the, you know, any website you will see this Mexican casta system very neatly staggered as if it's a ladder, and the names will tell you what exactly is being represented in that ladder so neatly. So Bianco or Blanco is, of course, the peninsula male, and the last on the rung is Mayan, and further after the African slaves are added to this system, it develops further rungs. So it's that historical context which I have long identified as a closed social system. It's very easy to think about this if we use R1, R2, R3 to represent different grades of reputation or social honor or dignity, and E1, E2, E3 as sort of economic wealth or class, if you will, or and P1, P2 as potestas or political authority, then in a closed social system, R1, E1, P1 will always belong together. That's what you see represented in the ladder scheme. So you can say white and mean rich, or you can say black and mean poor and dispossessed, and they act as synonyms for each other, so that you don't actually have to express the multiple layers and differences of wealth, power, and social standing in each of these cases. Now, that is very important to keep in mind, because this is the model against which and into which, from the 18th century itself, all the Orientalist writing on caste falls very neatly. So we have, in fact, this exact Iberian casta model becoming the mainframe for writing of the Indian caste system. I've put it on the board for you simply because it makes it visually very clear, and you can compare the Mexican and the Iberian model on the left and the Indian model on the right, and it's very, very easy to see how it works. And this is the model that has in fact been inherited by all English educated, liberal, nationalist, and Marxist, and post-colonial scholars, and into our time. This is what has been the main frame of Dalit, feminist theory, history, because it has also been embraced by men and politicians like Ambedkar and others, who also were coming from the same background. So this entire mainframe has completely ignored the kind of detailed work that scholars like all of you in this room have done, including Lubin's work or, McNathan's work and so on. So this is the context in which a frame like Brahmanical patriarchy emerged from about the 1990s. It was a frame first used by Ambedkar and then Uma Chakravarti, a major feminist activist, took this up and devised it as a term for discussing upper caste men's control over the sexuality of upper caste women, but it very soon got representative of all upper caste men versus all lower caste women and men alike. So that we have, very sophisticated sort of work now being done in Dalit feminist theory along these lines. Okay, I'm not going to read all of this out, but it basically falls very clearly along that grid that I just showed you, the ladder scheme. It's against that entire framing that I want to ask, what's the historical evidence for this? And how can we if we pay attention to what Gavin is saying about the attraction to verticality in the context of multiple religious experiences, how can we think about it? What I'm trying to do here is therefore think about caste, gender, and economics closely together in order to destabilize all hierarchies as impermanent and therefore in flux in each period of history that we are looking at. So that's the context in which I'm going to talk about Yajmani. And you know this better than I do, that a person who sponsors a yajna is a yajman or judgman, from the sort of way that is written in vernacular languages. And therefore, from this emerged a relationship that allowed lower caste disciples to sponsor and patronize the Brahman, both in the latter's capacity as teacher as well as the performer of ritual functions. So by 1855, Horace Wilson, eminent Orientalist and Indologist, all of you know, defines the Yajman in his glossary in two different places. One, on the left, is a person who employs and fees Brahmins. It's not unusual for the relationship between the employer and employed to become hereditary. On the right-hand side is his definition from some part of Tamil-speaking countries where the guru-shishya relationship is not mentioned at all. On the left, the guru-shishya relationship is mentioned. Now that's, I think, pretty significant because you compare, I think what is going on is that he's inviting us to think about Yajmani itself as differently worked out in regional societies. And I prefer to think about this in regionally specific terms because, you know, I'm following on the scholarship of a lot of people from all of you here, but S.C. Banerjee and N. Bhattacharjee, B. Bhattacharjee, Kvern, and others who have shown that from the 6th, 7th century onwards, there's a sort of emergence or convergence of Tantric Buddhist rituals and Shaiva Shakta rituals, specifically all across the Himalayan foothills. And they seep into the plains of Eastern India as well. And with the rise of the sort of Tantra particularly, you get the significance of the mantra initiating guru, the Ishta Devata, the sort of Kula Devata, Grama Devata becoming tripartite. And therefore, the potential for substantial peasants who are non-Brahmins or petty shopkeepers and artisans to be initiated disciples of personal gurus, worship a personal deity, that is an Ishta Devata, given by the Guru Mantra, and simultaneously, as part of a village collective or a lineage, employ Brahmin Purohits to either serve the lineage or village temple and deity, means that there can be a lot of Devata dichrony. You know, there's no Devata synchrony, as it were. And this is where I believe the potential that all of us are grappling with, which is that there is Shaiva ritual with, you know, a particular Kula Devata or a Gram Devata, which is different, that messiness, that hybridity that all of us have grappled with, I think is actually a lived experience and is a reflection of that lived experience in village and historical societies. And of course, Rembert's work has shown us that for the 15th century, the rich Boiddo's son, Paramananda Das's work shows us that he calls Chaitanya his Ishta Devata and Kula Devata, right? So he can do that because his father supports Chaitanya as well and the whole sort of parampara. So, but by the 17th century, in the evidence that we have, the disciples for such Vaishnav gurus are coming from much lower caste statuses in the Bengal countryside. I have a document, and some of my documents are taken from Mondol, Chitipotre, Shamad Chitro. A document of 1657, which invokes a Vaishnav Ishta Devata on the top of a list, and then lists names of disciples of weavers, tanti, farmers, barbers, including a group named Aguri. So let me go there and show it to you. I've got the whole page out. I'm sorry, this is a printed page. I couldn't do a bigger font in for this. But if you look very closely, you will see right on the second line, Ramuachi Aguri, okay, Gopalpurer Gaucharan Sarkar, Bandra Nilukesh Aguri. Aguris are a sort of indeterminate caste group in the 17th century, half warrior, half sort of cultivator. They haven't quite, militias. Guardsmen, militias, and so on. So, a sum from 1 rupee from each of these households to a guru whose name is missing, has been torn from the top, is missing from the top of the document, but appended to the same document on a separate page is a document dated 1668 CE or 1075 Bangla era, Sean, which also lists names of identical non-Brahmin castes and professions paying annual sums of a rupee each to their guru. Amongst these is included a son of a Vaishnav Gayan, as well as an old prostitute, Rani Buri. Okay. They're all disciples of a guru who they are paying 1 rupee to. So these collections of money were important to the Brahmin gurus, and this is what is very clear here, that they live off these collections. Take, for instance, an undated letter written by, this time, Durga invoking Brahmin to his main disciple sponsor, identified as Pradhan Shishya, chief disciple. I'm translating, this is my translation. This year, there has been no grain harvested in any part of my Brahmottara land. Thus, this year, I could not accumulate the means for establishing the Shiv Pratishtha, the Shivir icon, the icon of Shiv. The bare cost of the household itself is a burden. The forthcoming wedding of the middle brother's daughter has made me very anxious, unquote. This particular Brahmin then went on to provide a list of his annual earnings, of annual donations from other Shishyas, and expenses to his main disciple patron. This list is headed Shishyobatir Adai Jama O Kharach. Now, Jama and Kharach are exactly Mughal Persian terms for accounts. Okay, so these are terms of revenue collection and expenditure, and it's a document being produced by a Shoibo Brahman, Purohit, who also caters to all of these disciples. But he identifies each of these disciples by their caste names, and these are very clearly Ghosh, Bosh, Banik, Chasha, Aguri, and so on again. So these non-Brahmin lower caste patrons then all had contributed annually to the subsistence of this Brahmin household. The latter had used this small sums of money to provide himself with a mosquito net, clothes for 2 daughters-in-law, an iron-tipped sandal. Okay. All of this is Jama Kharach accounts given to the people whom he is writing to, his chief disciple. That he's giving accounts, I haven't wasted your money, this is what I've done with it. Okay. If poor disciples sustained the Brahmins, it helps to explain why these disciples were in fact very important for the Brahmins to hang on to. A document of 1688 has 3 Vaishnav Purohits with Brahmin caste names, Bhattacharji and so on, acknowledging that in the future they would beg collectively from the same disciple households in a particular estate. Basically, they had fought with each other, and their collections weren't sustaining them. When such agreements failed, desperate Purohits charged other Brahmins with treachery, of having collected from their disciples and failed to give them their shares, and so on and so forth. But what is also extremely clear from such accounts is that these same households had separate lists for the women who they were getting diksha from particular gurus and also sustaining them in their individual capacities. Among three such lists in Mandal's collection of documents, all are of non-Brahmin women who had received mantra diksha from Brahmin gurus and thus confirmed a sort of pattern of anuloma vaidhi bhakti, which all of you will recognize, as the guru is always the superior caste and the disciples are of the lower caste. But this is the sort of list that you have here. Okay. If you look at the top, you will see Dikharjai. Okay, I've circled it. And the list of women. It's very significant because the mantra bestowing Brahman gurus that each household is identified with, these household lists are kept by the gurus and they are identifying the women in terms of their marital kinship and other relationships in clusters. So, so-and-so's three, so-and-so's potni. Sometimes there's a name, sometimes there isn't. Sometimes it's even widows are marked by the Chandrabindu, that is, you know, wife of, or, and therefore the Chandrabindu marks the deceased or late, so-and-so. So there are widows in this list, there are married women in this list, and some of them have their names and some of them don't. But what caught my eye was that, you know, that Devuta asynchrony that I had already mentioned, that there are two women who are getting Vaishnav mantra here and two or three Durga mantra. So it's Vaishnav and Shaiva Shakta sort of initiations are being given by the same people. And that means they have to perform according to what the judgments ask of them. They're not actually being identified in terms of any kind of pure lineage of their own. Okay. So why were these women, and that was my question, why were these women so important to these gurus? Letters from the women confirm the dependence of the gurus on these women, especially the lower caste disciple, patron, and judgman households. A letter from a woman who signed herself, I quote, "your most obedient female disciple." Now, you know, this is something that I want to ask all of you about, all of you who are specialists in the 17th century Bangla language. They always identify the female in words that I am not familiar with from the 19th century, like Shishani, you know, Brahmani. They will always make sure Kulini, right? They will always make sure that the gender of the caste is being signaled in this way. So she is a Shishani. Her name is Gayatri. She begins by recounting that her guru, a Brahmin named Madhusudan Dev Sharmanno, had asked her for some cash to enable him to conduct a ritual on a particular astrological conjunction. Confessing her inability to send the sum of 4 rupees, this female disciple patron sent in instead a silk shari, toshor, it's written, that she hoped could be used to either sell on the market and earn the money and then pay for the ritual, or be used in the ritual itself. In addition to this, she sent for his personal consumption 2 jars of homemade relish, some locally made grown aniseed, and for his daughter-in-law as well, some local cumin seeds. Okay. These are kinds of goods that a woman herself would have used in a domestic context. And it suggests that even if humble, the dutiful woman of property was fundamental to the survival of this poorer and dependent household of the Brahmin teacher. Such letters reveal not merely that women disciples, cum judgments of non-Brahmin households, had in fact kept both the men and women of the Brahmins alive, but they also invite us to rethink the nature of judgmani relationships as part of a regime of pastoral governmentality. You will recognize this term from Foucault, but you know, I think his understanding or his focus on the Catholic pastor is very limited. It can be secularized, and my argument is that it's in fact these poorer disciples who are the actual pastoral sustainers of the regime that is run by the Brahmins. Okay. So I'm proposing that we think of women of different generations and marital statuses and lower castes as pastoral governors in their own right. Okay, so redoing Foucault and resituating him for our Bengali 17th century context. In other words, governmentality was neither sex segregated nor sect segregated. That's what I'm arguing. And such non-Brahmin households and their economic viability also pushed the Eastern Indian Brahmins to remain fairly eclectic and able to provide for different groups of people demanding different kinds of rituals. In other words, I'm also willing to challenge with some caution and due respect to people sitting here, you know, the kind of theological clean lines that are suggested by modern bhakti studies. And I am much more sympathetic to scholars like Tony Stewart, who has already gestured at what he found in his Gaudiya Vaishnav texts of the 17th century. Remember, he found Tantric and Buddhist mandalas. This is his work, Replicating Vaishnav Worlds. In case, Tony, you've forgotten your own work. Okay.
And that's what happens when you retire.
Yeah, right. So I'm reminding you. And S.C. Banerjee refers to unpublished manuscripts on Tantra in copious terms in Bishnupur in the 17th century and so on. So there is enormous evidence that what we are finding in the texts is also resonant with practice, village practice, local level practice, household practices, okay, and relationships. And therefore, it's very commonplace for a Jajman Bhakta to write to a Vaishnav elder Goswamiji in the same period. I quote, "I'm sending 1 rupee, 7 seers of cotton, 4 seers of til. We are troubled by the legal disputes, Kasjia, with a Kashinath Rai of Srirampur. Please offer a pujo to the Shingho Bahini." Okay, so here is a Vaishnav Shamiji, Goswami, being asked to pray to Shingubahini, the lion-riding goddess, or Durga, and please make sure that we are soon released from our difficulties. We have only this to lay at your feet, unquote. So it's to these ritualized relationships between Shishya and Brahman gurus that I'm calling Jajmani, and I am going to say in the next part of the talk that I have only 10 minutes for, that I'm taking this into the period of the 18th century in the household of a Ghosh Sharkar from Birbhum, Shurul. This is a household which, by the way, the Jajmani, the lower caste women that I was talking about, is precisely the model for Ramakrishna, the setting up of the Kali, the mandir, you know, in by Rani Rashmuni, and the Ramakrishna as the mystic, who's actually a Purohit, and who with his nephew is appointed as the priest of this temple that the woman builds. Okay, and Rashmuni is a Namashudra. She is in fact of the rising lower caste at this time. And this is how she chooses to use her money. She is the employer, the judgment of the Brahmin mystic. We know much more about the Brahmin male mystic because he became the object of a lot of devotional groups of unemployed young and old men in the 19th century in Eastern India. We don't know enough about this pattern of women and of lower caste backgrounds employing these priests. And that's what I'm trying to provide here. But what's the point of this in terms of capital or capitalism? This is where the Vaishnav Shadgopes as merchants come in. I'm using a bunch of documents from called the Shurul correspondence. And the Shurul household begins with the Krishna Hari Ghosh, his son, Yadubendra Ghosh Sarkar, and then grandson, who is around the late 18th century, but he's dead by 1797, great-grandsons, all of whom work with the East India Company, but having bought up a little bit of land, 9 moja, from the late Mughal zamindar, Birbhum, Muhammad Zaman Khan. So they make that little bit of land the focus of buying out all the Brahmatar and Lakhiraj. Lakhiraj is tax-exempt lands, which have hitherto been given by various Muslim Nawabs and Amirs of the region to the Brahmins. These guys buy them all off and turn the Brahmins into agents, mercantile agents of under their employ. So what you have is old-time priests and ritualists becoming mercantile agents, okay? As a result of this kind of colonial expansion of land and commerce and trade. So I'm going to show you a little bit of the kind of collections I work in. Shurul Nothi Sankalan, very much, of the state that all of you are familiar with, but the reason that it appeals to me is because of that seal, Zaman Khan's seal and old writing, and of course this is the place of very famous Birbhum terracottas. This is the region that you may all be familiar with already. I just put it there because I didn't know how many or who would be familiar, but of course I'm speaking to experts here. These are the temples that are still standing. One of them I have photographed in detail because it has electrical wires that have been put up, and so it's in use. The others are sort of, tilting and falling down, and there is still worship there, but it's hard to maintain it. And this household became zamindars complete with dalan, that is Rajbari, is palace, palatial building, and Durga Dalan is the, the one in front where they do the major public worship. So letters from their Brahmin agent, Gotinath Dev Sharmanno, are what I'm looking at and saying as just a glimpse of what is possible if you keep Jajmani, the ritual and upturned nature of the hierarchical relationship. The Brahmin is ritually on top, but economically the poorer, dependent creature. And ritually, the Ghoshes are juniors, but they are economically the seniors, right, in this relationship. And what happens if you read with that upside down hierarchy, destabilized hierarchy in your head, these letters? Gotinath Dev Sharmanno wrote to his non-Brahmin judgman, Ashanando Sarkar, saying that what had happened was that in the heat of the summer month of 1821, the Brahmin servant had tersely reprimanded his master, even as he addressed him affectionately as Babaji. The employer had overloaded a river boat with its cargo of sugar to be sold at Kolkata. The boat had encountered a thunderstorm and floods en route, and the servant had been delayed in unloading the cargo for sale in Kolkata city. Perhaps some of the packages had become heavier with water, or the sugar itself damaged. The sale of the consignment proved difficult. Other intermediaries informed the employer, who in turn had scolded Gotinath. A month later, Gotinath responded to such a charge in another letter to his employer. This one interspersed commercial information regarding prices, sales of sugar, cloth, indigo dyes in the Calcutta market, with reminders of the Jajmani relationships that undergirded their formal contractual one. The letter used terms of nurture and obligation, pratipalana, reminding the master, your ancestors have habitually... Okay, it's fine, it's exiting. It's fine, let it exit. Your ancestors have habitually nourished the Brahmins. Are you going to renounce the ancestral ways? Regardless of your suspicion, I have never adopted unfair means. I've never adopted dishonest, harmful conduct, adharma acharan, towards your concern. Babaji, you have been the nourisher, we the nourished, unquote. Even when the employer sent a requisition was unfair, this 50-year-old Brahmin reminded him that he had served for 16 years at an urban outpost where costs had gone up. But if this was not acceptable, then his final recourse was to the pride in a renunciant's life. So his letter goes, I am by jati a Brahmin. I am unseduced by the prospect of a feast. My translation is Udoranir Nimitte Lalaito Nohen. Is that a fair enough translation? I mean, tell me, Tony, later if I'm doing this right. I am content to beg with a bag on my shoulder. I am unafraid to sleep on a bed of nails. Let me know the name of your next Gomashta in Calcutta, and I will hand over the business to him and depart. Unquote. Apparently, the employer responded to this proud servant not by dismissing him outright, but by appointing another agent to the management of his businesses in Kolkata, dividing the work between his various Brahmin employees and agents. And by 1825, the letters reveal this Brahmin was responsible for the sale of indigo alone in the city. Yet even on this account, he was suffering major losses on behalf of his employer. I looked it up, indigo prices were down in 1820s. This commercial failing on his own part drove home his dependence even more clearly. For in one of his letters to his employer, he wrote, he had no desire to harm their prosperity, for after all, it was on their prosperity that the world flourished. Tomra desher bodhishto lok, tomader sri sri protul korilei onekir mongol, onekir bhorta. You feed many others. All of this discourse, while formal, reminds us of the priority of ritualized social obligations that might have continued to condition the functions of markets even in the early 19th century. For at least one set of letters reveals that the Brahmin client continued to serve his patron by continued demonstrations of esteem, offering a variety of information of markets, people, even actual physical labor at the heart of Jajmani. Especially from the vantage point of households and lineages to which the Brahmin dependents belonged, such ritualized obligations and obedience also ensured the subsistence of the women of these Brahmin households. The preponderance of these ritualized obligations also help us to understand a little better the futility of our modern expectations of a collective resistance from the first servant to either the conditions of his employment or to the nature of the work demanded from him. In other words, they remind us of Gavin Flood's words about the centrality of vertical relationships in the study of religions. The letters that I have used suggest that the Brahmin servant preferred to maintain the chain of obligations, and when he threatened to break them, it was as a renunciant of the worldly order itself, rather than in solidarity with those workers who were his social inferiors. The key question remains, why did the Jajmans continue to maintain such a recalcitrant Brahmin on their rolls? Perhaps they too had a sense of hereditary obligations, or perhaps because the market in literacy and accounting had not yet expanded beyond that of the Brahmin Kayastha monopoly. Thank you.